We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short, and this is ACAM Learn.
Hello and welcome to the Mind the Kids podcast series. I'm Mark Tebbs, I'm your host for today. I've kind of spent my whole career working in mental health, from frontline services through to kind of director of mental health commissioning in the charity sector, NHS and social care. I'm currently chief exec of an infrastructure charity, so I'm really interested in how we kind of support grassroots organisations and that kind of community impact. And I guess that background in commissioning kind of makes me really interested around how we understand need, lived experience, evidence, practice, and how we really measure impact and value for money. And I'm also a parent and, and have seen the system from a kind of parent's perspective too. So I'm really delighted to be hosting the podcast. In these episodes, we have the opportunity to talk to researchers and practitioners about their research. It's an opportunity to talk and shine a light on some of the latest developments in children and adolescent mental health research. Today, I'm going to be talking about nature connectedness. So how nature connectedness supports learning and well-being, and how we can create opportunities for that felt experience.
It does. Wow.
So I'm delighted to be joined by Nicole Harris, who's the lead author of a recent systematic literature review on nature connectedness. Nicole, it's great to be speaking with you.
Mark, it's really, really lovely to be here. Thank you for asking me in.
Great stuff. So let's start with some introductions. So if you could tell us kind of maybe where you work and some of your kind of research interests.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Nicole Harris. I currently work at Portsmouth City Council as an educational psychologist, and I'm a visiting academic at the University of Southampton, which is where I studied to become an educational psychologist.
Part of my role at the moment is I'm chief exec of an infrastructure charity, and we work with a lot of charity and community groups that are in place around connectedness to well-being for young people. And I guess one of the things we hear quite a lot is how difficult it is to, especially when trying to work with schools, how difficult it is to kind of get on the curriculum, how pressured that curriculum space is. So I'd like a little bit of an elevator pitch. So if you've had some school head teachers and you're trying to really sell the importance of nature connectedness and its impact on kind of learning and behavior, then, and how would you do that?
Absolutely. And I think in a way that is the reason for the area that I did study, which was on the behaviors for learning, was to try and give another sort of hook for a head teacher. So I guess my elevator pitch would be that nature supports optimum development in so many ways. The more we look, the more we discover about how being in nature sort of influences our physical and our mental health. And that this systematic literature review showed just how many different ways there are to support increased nature connectedness, which then also improves behaviors for learning. So in a nutshell, that having opportunities to connect with nature as being part of the national curriculum would help our young people connect with nature. It would be better for their well-being. It would be better for their ability to learn and engage with learning. And it would be better for the planet. So it's just win-win-win, really.
Brilliant. Great pitch. And it feels intuitively right as part of my preparation for the podcast. Yeah. Went for a walk, and it's kind of being in nature just kind of grounds us so much, I think. So
yeah, so absolutely.
Let's get into that into a little bit more detail. So what do we exactly mean by nature connectedness in the context of child and adolescent development, and why is it so important?
So nature connectedness, when we talk about nature connectedness, we're typically talking about a relationship, a felt relationship with nature. And we see this as something different from time in nature or sort of exposure to green space, which isn't to say that time in nature or exposure to green space aren't good in and of themselves. But when we're talking about nature connectedness, it's much more a felt relationship. And we can think about that with people as well. We can be in a shared space with people, you know, at home or in an open plan office and not necessarily feel that we have a relationship with them. So that's really where nature connectedness, I guess, differs as a construct. And I would say that there's, with linking nature connectedness to behaviors for learning, I think this is sort of quite a nascent area of research. And so starting to look into that, we've typically, a lot of the research has tried to ground it in a couple of different psychological theories. So they've looked at sort of attention restoration theory or Ulrich's stress reduction theory, biophilia hypothesis from Wilson. And if we think that certain aspects of, say, behavior for learning, like attention, could link quite logically to something like attention restoration theory, or, you know, the aspects of well-being could link quite well to stress reduction theory. If we're thinking about how it links to learning, we're sort of opening up the door, I believe, a bit more on some of the unknowns that the sort of the core theories that we have been using, including nature connectedness, don't necessarily tap into all of the areas where we might see how it could influence behaviors for learning. So that's one of the avenues that one of the co-authors on the paper with me, Bea Hartwell, and I are exploring, is whether if we look at it more from sort of a neuroception and Stephen Porges's polyvagal theory, whether that as an underpinning theory may speak slightly more to how nature connectedness does influence behaviors for learning.
Okay, so could you unpack that a little bit? So you mentioned the polyvagal theory. So some people might not be familiar with that. So
yeah, absolutely. And like I said, it's something that we are just starting to explore. So neuroception polyvagal theory is very much about sort of it's our nervous system and our fight flight response, and the idea being that if we are in fight flight, if we're in a heightened state, you know, we're not in a fit state to learn. You know, our body is in that like run away, stay safe, not sort of the rest and digest, not the ability to be social, not the ability to engage with the prefrontal cortex, really. So it's almost sort of bringing more aspects of nature and how that can allow us to attune with our almost with our inner nature using the outer nature, and with that sort of down-regulating our nervous system, calming internally so that we can engage with learning. So like I said, that's currently what we are looking into to see whether that could be a better theory in which to ground how nature connectedness does influence behaviors for learning.
Okay, so is that a sense that a kind of disconnection with nature is aligned to maybe a disconnection with self and learning?
Yeah, I think we are. That is what we're sort of definitely feeling our way into. I know we're almost sort of starting with a tail end here, because we haven't actually really sort of spoken that much about what the paper found. But I think, you know, going at this from
dived in, haven't we?
we really, really have, absolutely. So the systematic literature review was really sort of dipping our toe in the water to see whether there was actually evidence that connecting children with nature could have an influence on behaviors for learning. And the short answer to that was yes, that there was a lot of evidence to show this. 68% of the papers found that the activities designed to increase nature connectedness in children and young people did increase nature connectedness. Interestingly, 77% of studies saw an impact on behaviors for learning. So we were seeing a positive impact on behaviors for learning, even where we didn't necessarily see an impact on nature connectedness. So with that, and I guess myself quite naively going into the research at the outset, and this feeds into the theories, the main theories underpinning a lot of nature connectedness research, the thought that I would see a lot of evidence for improved attention, improved engagement, that aspect of sort of behaviors for learning. But if we consider that behaviors for learning exist across like a broader spectrum, there's the cognitive aspect, absolutely, but there's also the social aspect and there's the emotional aspect. And what a lot of the research that was coming back from the systematic literature review was really showing, the main impact was actually on social skills. And then the second main impact, as it were, was on self-regulation. So really, really seeing an impact on areas that I wouldn't have necessarily have thought to look for, but this is very much what the papers were showing. And for me, what was super interesting with this as well was that a lot of the evidence was from qualitative studies. So it wasn't like they were stating what they were going out and looking for. They were just asking for feedback in terms of what was seen, which is why I think we do get such a broad range of behaviors for learning that have come back. Because I think if we had done it as a quantitative study and just asked for feedback on something like attention, we would have missed a huge amount of what the impact of these nature connectedness activities actually delivered to the young people. So starting it there at the tail end with the results of the systematic literature review, where we were really seeing sort of a huge impact on social skills and on self-regulation, feeling that, you know, attention restoration theory, stress reduction theory didn't necessarily hold all of what we were seeing. So it was trying to go back sort of more generally to the literature, to our understanding of sort of body mind, all of, you know, this sort of embodied learning and feeling that in this context, something like polyvagal theory, where you are calming that nervous system response, where you are then in a frame of mind where you can engage socially. So what we're seeing with the improved social skills, and where you are have a better understanding and better control over your body. So the self-regulation skills may well explain the improvements on behavior for learning that we're seeing.
Fascinating. So look, I'm going to row us back a little bit because we have dived in. So could you just describe, when we're sort of building up that picture around what we mean, so what are some of those practical low-cost ways that kind of groups, schools can deliberately foster nature connectedness in children and young people?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what, again, was really interesting about the systematic literature review. It was just the huge variety of activities that schools were delivering. So if I start by saying, like, in a way, the purpose of the literature review at the outset was to try and find what schools were actually delivering on school sites. So this really would have been sort of a useful guide for what schools could reasonably replicate. But there was very little in the literature in terms of activities that had been carried out on school sites. So it was broadened out that little bit to sort of include any educational setting. And then with that, it had to be activities where one of the markers, the data that they were seeking to collect, was actually on nature connectedness. So again, you know, it's not to say that there are other schools and centers carrying out sort of a wider range of activities, but sort of one of the keys from our point of view was to look whether they were collecting data on nature connectedness and on behaviors for learning. So that being said, there was a huge variety of different activities, you know, so some young people were taken surfing, you know, on the south coast of England, some young people were hiking in Scotland, there were some taking place in southern Africa. But if we look at the activities that were sort of very implementable on a school site, we saw a lot of things like playing in nature. We saw things like getting your hands dirty, you know, literally getting your hands dirty, you know, connecting with the microbiome, with the dirt and the leaves and bits and pieces like that. There were art-based activities, so doing things like sunlight photography. There was another one in Canada again about sort of using, so as opposed to sunlight photography, where you're using the sun to take pictures, using actual cameras to take pictures of nature that elicited an emotional connection with you. But a lot of it was about going out and trying to build a connection. And sometimes that's this, you know, starting with as simply as laying in the grass and paying attention to what you can see, paying attention to what you can hear, you know, just being present in that moment, being mindful in that moment, and trying to build that connection. So what I'm saying, a huge range of activities. There was art-based ones where you're sort of working with nature to create sort of art installations. There was things like songwriting in nature. There were things like playing in nature. There were, a whole spectrum of activities that didn't necessarily involve, and this is what we were really, really keen to show, it didn't necessarily involve being in deepest, darkest, wild nature, you know, sort of rainforests of Western Canada, as you will, you know, that these schools were using bits of nature that were accessible to them, either on their school site. You know, some schools clearly have access to much better green space than others, but even the ones where there was a lot of sort of tarmacked yard, they could build raised beds. Some of them were digging up bits of their yard so that they could put in a pond. Some of them were sort of managing bits of woodland that they hadn't sought to use before. So it was almost, you know, bits of the school ground that had been fenced off that they're now creating access to. Or there were schools that had allotments next door or would have a churchyard next door.
So a huge range of activities, a huge range of opportunities. And opportunities for kind of schools to be creative in their local environment. So what are some of the challenges that schools face in trying to develop those opportunities?
So my research didn't necessarily look at that, but I know there is research recently done by, I think, Amy Patchen, who very much did look at what are sort of the barriers to sort of outdoor education in young people. And I think what they found were, I guess, in many ways, the not surprising things, the time, you know, literally having time in the day, the curriculum pressures, you know, schools are under such pressure to deliver. There were things like, you know, the risk, health and safety. We're taking children outside, you know, oh my goodness, they might get wet or muddy or dirty. But, you know, there are realities with that. There can be stings, there can be, you know, sunburn, things like that. But I would argue probably not necessarily much more than what most children would be exposed to when they're out playing at lunchtime or break anyway. But I think what was interesting, what she found was one of the key takeaways is that it's not necessarily the individual barriers in a school that are the problem. It's the overlapping of the barriers. So it can be quite easy to unpick them one at a time. So it can be quite easy, for instance, to find time in the day for one class to go outside. But how do you find time across the week for all classes in a school to go outside? Because, of course, like at time, like, say, lunchtime, everyone is out at the same time and you're not managing that experience in quite the same way as you might be able to do if you go out as a single class. And so if you do have a small woodland area where you'd like to do sort of some specific activities in, how are you literally timetabling that across the day, across the week, so that everyone has equitable access to that? Yeah. So I think, you know, that was the key takeaway, I think, from her paper, that you have to do a systems approach to it, that it's not necessarily an easy solve, that you need to simultaneously be looking at all of the barriers and looking to resolve them almost simultaneously. But that it, you know, there's no reason why it's not doable. You know, these things are hard until they're done. And then I think they're done. And I think the other takeaway was that the barriers are quite often school specific. You know, some of them, of course, will overlap, like the curriculum demands. But some of them are sort of more specific to the schools.
I guess there's an inequality aspect to this in terms of people from more deprived areas have less access to kind of green space. So it feels like there needs to be some work in that policy and practice implementation space. We're going to, you know, think about it from that perspective too.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the research shows that, you know, children and young people from more deprived areas have 9% less access to green spaces. And that's one of the main areas why we'd really love to see sort of opportunities to connect with nature as being part of the school curriculum. You know, it makes it equitable for all children and young people. And in that way, you're then sort of trying to centralize sort of a green space, a green ability to connect, making it something that all children and young people can benefit from. There's really strong evidence that shows that there's a link between sort of being connected to nature as a child that follows through. You then remain an adult who has strong nature connectedness. So typically we would then see that that works the other way around as well, isn't it? That nature connectedness is something that, you know, parents can pass on to their children. But if that isn't actually happening, if that is what has been broken, then to, you know, to reverse that cycle, we do need to start developing that sense of nature connectedness in young children so that they do grow up to be adults who are connected to nature, who then pass that on to their children, you know, to build that back into our way of being.
Yeah, we've just had the psychiatric morbidity survey released kind of like in June, and it kind of really talked about the kind of rising kind of mental health problems, particularly in girls. So I just wondered, was there anything in the systematic review which picked up on that kind of gender aspect?
So nothing that I picked up in this paper. I have written another paper which sort of looked at how well-being decreases from primary school as you head into secondary school and through secondary school, how nature connectedness also decreases through primary school into secondary school. So there seems to be a bit of a pivot point around the age of 11 at which nature connectedness starts to change. There's a lot of evidence that shows that being strongly connected to nature is actually linked to well-being, to positive well-being. So there's been sort of, you know, quite a few studies, especially in adults, sort of promoting nature connectedness as a way of improving well-being. So again, in terms of sort of my research looking to improve nature connectedness in young people as a way to conceivably offset that decrease in well-being. as you then ride through the sort of the bumpy low well-being period of secondary school before you come out the other side. So there would be, you know, which is another really, really strong argument of trying to get nature connectedness programs into primary school so that we're getting, you know, that nature connectedness as high as we can, as early as we can, that we're then buffering, hopefully, declines in well-being going into secondary school. And sort of tying back to what you're saying about difference in ages, I think what that sort of the papers that I was looking at showed was that girls quite often have lower well-being going through secondary school. But interestingly, boys have lower nature connectedness. So in a weird way, sort of you have the potential to benefit both boys and girls from almost different points of view, and that you can be using increasing nature connectedness to shore up the well-being of girls. But equally, you can also use the programs to increase the nature connectedness of boys, which has historically been lower than girls. So it does have potential impacts to have great positive impacts on both in slightly different ways.
Okay. And I'm also interested in that special educational needs perspective. Was anything in the systematic review that picked up on their particular needs?
So not so much, although I know there have been sort of other papers that have picked up on it a little bit. I don't think there's been a huge amount of research. I think I was reading from someone that there isn't a huge amount of research into nature connectedness and children with special educational needs and disabilities. I guess I would have a wonder around that. And within educational psychology, we quite often try and push back that little bit in that sort of saying that, you know, good teaching benefits all learners, you know, so that in a way, in adopting an inclusive practice, why would we segregate? And in this way, I would equally say that, you know, the opportunity to connect with nature benefits all learners. So would we want to sort of focus on one particular group? I would also sort of bring to that as an educational psychologist, you know, right now, so many of the schools and so many of the young people that I'm being asked to work with have difficulties with emotional regulation. You know, we're seeing a lot of really, really dysregulated children in schools. And, you know, we're now labeling them almost as special educational needs and disability, you know, to ensure that they get the support that they need. But is this, strictly speaking, you know, an educational need or a disability? Or are these children that really just need support to connect with themselves, you know, to be able to sort of emotionally regulate, to feel better in and of themselves? So I guess that's a really sort of long way round of saying that I imagine there probably are benefits to it. And that is, again, with Bea Hartwell, a thesis that we're supervising right now, where Imogen Gray is working with 5 different schools, and she is looking at small groups of children who do struggle with emotional regulation to see more specifically how it may impact on them. So I don't have a direct answer to that. It is something that we are working on. I know, sort of extending this a little bit back, feeding back to what you were saying about, you know, barriers to introducing sort of nature connectedness activities in schools. I know that, I think it was Amy Patchen again, her research showed that actually sometimes teachers almost take their children out less frequently to ensure equitable access to the outdoors. And because quite often children with special education needs and disabilities are withdrawn from classes for specialist intervention, that this is another one of the sort of the systemic barriers, that if your children are out of class quite regularly, they may well actually be missing out on it. So some teachers are making the choice of not going out so that none of the children miss out, if that makes sense. So again, it's something systemically that schools would need to look at as to, you know, if the class was going outside, to make sure that none of the interventions were taking place in that time to ensure that actually everyone could go out.
Yeah, it sounds like it has the potential to be really an inclusive part of the curriculum that actually benefits everyone in potentially different ways.
And I think with this, and this is what I've sort of seen, I guess, you know, anecdotally, is that, you know, when I used to work in a secondary school, when we took the kids out who did struggle with being in a class, who did struggle with sitting still, who did struggle with attention and impulsivity, and you took them outside where they were allowed to be, you know, the skills that those children displayed was huge. You know, they came into their own, and, you know, things like their leadership ability or their organizational skills or their enthusiasm. Yeah, it lets children shine in a way that maybe they can't always do in class. And that, in terms of self-esteem, is a huge motivator.
You mentioned earlier a little bit about the climate crisis. And so I'm just kind of wondering about the connection to kind of like ecological anxieties. I think we see that as part of the, you know, the mixture of mental health and well-being concerns that young people have. So is there like a connection between, or is there an opportunity around nature connectedness and that eco-anxiety?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think there's two elements to that. And it is, I think, necessary to acknowledge that, you know, feeling connected to nature may make you more prone to eco-anxiety and climate anxiety. You know, this is hardly surprising if, you know, if you feel strongly connected to something and you see it being sort of abused and not cared for, that really can elicit feelings of depression and anxiety and unhappiness. So, you know, 100% there is the potential for that correlation. On a more positive note, you know, there is a lot of evidence in the literature that shows that increasing nature connectedness increases pro-environmental behaviors. So you're more likely to get people acting in a way that is planet kind, you know, is looking after the planetary well-being. So increasing nature connectedness, hopefully in the long run, like I said, will have a more positive impact. And I think there's the idea too, as well, that with opportunities to come together and that sense of collective agency and collective action, where you have children who then maybe do feel part of a group, where you are working together to promote change, that you might get that little bit of hope that comes from that. You know, coming together as a class to connect with nature, you're connecting with potentially other like-minded children, you're no longer feeling so alone. You are getting more of that hopefully collective action, which is, you know, building sense of agency, which is then hopefully building sense of hope. I think a lot of young people as well feel particularly despondent because, you know, there's a sense that adults aren't doing anything. So if you get schools who are facilitating this, maybe there is that bit of a sense of some people are trying to do something. And there's also the potential for it being a space that you can share how you are feeling, you know, so that, again, you're not feeling sort of alone in that despondency, that you are with adults and peers who can maybe help you hold those feelings, express those feelings and work through them and work with it. So I think it's a complex one in that, you know, it has the potential to increase feelings of eco and anxiety and despondency. But equally, it can also flip that and make more people more climate aware, engage in more pro-environmental behaviours, and to carry that through then into adulthood, that is something that then sticks.
Yeah, so something that has to be really carefully managed, like the potential for it to raise anxieties as you kind of feel more connected. But also the opportunity for it to make you feel a little bit more powerful, that you can change things at that kind of like local level with peers. Yeah. It'd be really useful just to kind of broaden this out a little bit. So I'm just wondering what role nature connectedness could play in a wider strategic context, and particularly mindful around the epidemic in mental health concerns we've got at the moment in young people.
So I think in terms of supporting well-being, like I said, there's a huge evidence base around how initiatives to increase nature connectedness in adults supports adult well-being. And there's a growing evidence base in children and young people showing something similar. So again, this is coming back when we're talking about sort of the underpinning theories. I think we're looking at it quite often from, you know, stress reduction theory. We're also looking at it from like biophilia hypothesis, that, you know, we evolved as part of nature. You know, there's an attitude right now where we're talking about nature disconnection. But the truth is we are a part of nature. Nature connectedness isn't a new thing. The element that's new is the disconnection from nature. And like we were talking about earlier, the disconnection from ourselves as well. So B and I refer to sort of like our inner nature as well as our outer nature. I think, you know, programs or initiatives that really support us, it is almost just engaging with ourselves, like the who we are, who we evolved to be, how we evolved to be. You know, we have been modern humanity for a very, very small dot of time, if we think of sort of evolution of humanity in the longer term. So coming back in a way to policy and the rest of that, if we have to make it a policy to reconnect with, I guess, in a way, how we're meant to be or who we're meant to be or things that work well for us, you know, it is almost like we have just forgotten what is regulating for us. And, you know, we did grow up outside, as it were, if we think about that. So it's hardly surprising. Like Mark, you said, you know, preparing for this, you went for a walk outside, and I imagine it probably helped, you know, sort of calm you down a little bit, tamed the squirrely thoughts a little bit. And it does, you know, I think we all have this, we talk quite often about sort of evidence-based practice. And we can flip that to sort of practice-based evidence, you know, when we pay attention to how certain things make us feel. And I think nature connectedness is one of those things. So if we do have to start putting it into policy, and that's where I would love to see it to sit, that it does become part of school policy for opportunities to engage outside with nature in a way that promotes nature connectedness. And we have this multitude of benefits, you know, we're getting children outside, we're getting them connecting with nature, where we're getting them active, we're getting them connecting with themselves. We've got the knock-on benefits of improved well-being, of improved physical health. And, you know, as that final carrot for schools to make room for it in their curriculum, it makes them better learners because, you know, their nervous system is regulated. They can actually engage with learning. And they might then hopefully have that motivation to engage with learning as well.
Brilliant. We haven't mentioned sort of technology up to now. I just wondered where, because it kind of feels like spending time in nature could also be kind of part of an antidote around kind of getting off kind of screen time as well. And I wonder whether the research kind of like explored that at all.
I don't know that I can speak to that directly, because I think quite often we get conflicting evidence from the effects of social media, isn't it? You know, there's times where it can be positive and encourage a sense of belonging. And then there can be times where there's negative aspects that we see to it. So I think, you know, absolutely children and young people are spending much more time inside these days. They're spending much more time online these days. But I also think we need to tread carefully about sort of vilifying technology completely, because I think it sometimes is one of those things that we do have to work with. So I know that there are, for instance, apps that you can get on phones, which are about getting children and young people outside and engaging with nature. And in that case, if that's the element that gets them outside and engaging in some way, that I would see that as a positive first step, and, you know, hopefully leading to then at some stage leaving the phones behind. But equally, we're seeing, you know, taking pictures of nature can be a really strong way of supporting nature connectedness, and most of us would be taking pictures on our phone right now, so that is using technology as a way of engaging. I know for me, one of the ways that I stay connected with my family in Canada is taking pictures of nature and sending them back and forth. And so I wouldn't want to say categorically, you know, all technology bad. You know, will I say that yes, children are inside much more? Yes. You know, are they on gadgets much more? Yes. You know, and this has been building for a really, really long time. And I think this is, you know, where Richard Louvin and, you know, the idea of nature disconnectedness has first come in, that kids aren't out roaming anymore and sort of playing sort of the unsupervised play. And there's many reasons for this.
So, okay, look, we're coming to the kind of towards the end of the podcast. So I'm really interested to know whether you've got any future research in the field, or whether you're aware of any other kind of studies that are kind of exploring some of the issues we've touched on today.
Yeah, so like, so we're B and I are currently supervising a PhD research right now, which is looking at sort of exploring from neuroception and Porges's polyvagal lens to see whether that's a way of understanding the impacts that we're seeing. We've also developed a scale which is looking at measuring what we've called sort of the sense of self, sort of, you know, how self-regulated or how self-aware a young person feels after sort of engaging with nature connectedness activities. There's a lot of research going on right now in the field of nature connectedness, which is super, super exciting and super interesting to see, and from different angles. So, you know, we're very much looking at it from the perspective of being educational psychologists and what we can do sort of in schools to help support this from that lens of supporting children engage with learning, be the best that they can be. Yeah, so I think if it is an area that people are interested in, nature connectedness is definitely sort of it's a very lively field at the minute right now. And there's lots of really interesting and really powerful research being carried out.
Yeah, amazing. Is there anything that you wanted to kind of share with our listeners that we haven't covered?
I think maybe, I guess my main takeaway would be, you know, for us to move beyond the idea of us not being nature. We are nature. It's been sort of, I guess, a very Western view to other things, you know, other than humanity, to put us at the top of all of the trees and to start seeing ourselves as part of that wider world, really. And how important that is, actually, that it's not just really, you know, a nice thing to think about, but that, you know, for our continued existence, for planetary well-being, we really do have to see ourselves as, you know, a cog in the wheel, as opposed to, you know, the driver of the bus in this, that we need to, yeah, be more consciously present. We need to value our connection with nature and look after, and through that, we're looking after both sort of planetary nature and ourselves.
Nicole, it's been such a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a really rich conversation. So thank you very much. Hope listeners, you've enjoyed the podcast. If you've enjoyed the podcast, then please leave a rating and a review. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Mark.